This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. Hurricane Matthew recovery continues throughout eastern North Carolina, including the largely rural county of Duplin on the banks of the Cape Fear River. Though it didn't have record-breaking flooding like neighboring Lenoir and Wayne counties along the Neuse River, the county has a long and costly recovery process ahead of them. Chris Thomas has this.
Starting over again isn't easy. That's where some Duplin County residents stand after Hurricane Matthew.
It really touches home and really touches your heart when you see those people that you know and you grew up with.
That's Matt Barwick, Kenansville native and the county's EMS director.
I know I've got friends that have agriculture operations that I grew up with, and they've been completely devastated by the flooding aspect, and just trying to get themselves on their feet as a new farming community, and this has basically wiped them out and made them start back over from the very start. So it touches things right here at home.
The Cape Fear River in Duplin County came a few feet short of setting new records, but parts of the county remained submerged for nearly a week, due in part to its terrain. Shane Kearns of the National Weather Service explains.
It's a really flat basin out there, so it covered a lot of ground, but the inundation wasn't as deep, so there weren't as many homes affected. But it certainly did cut off a lot of people from any roads that could get out of there, so it still caused major problems.
The flooding could have been worse in Duplin County, but it was by no means minor in scope. The Cape Fear River reached major flood stage on October 9th and stayed there until the 14th. The river in Chicopin crested at a record 23.51 feet in 1999. It came about 3 feet short of that mark this year.
It was pretty significant, probably just a step below Hurricane Floyd out there.
Eastern North Carolina, Duplin County included, was headline news across the nation that year. A New York Times article said the storm, which caused more than $1 billion in damage and killed 48 people, exposed major flaws in the state's farming system. A similar story was published in the Washington Post on October 16th, as livestock and their waste turned up across the region and its waterways after Matthew. While no human casualties were reported in Duplin County, home may mean something different for some residents. According to Barwick, more than 80 homes were impacted by the flood, 40 roads were unusable or washed away, and nearby water and sewer lines were damaged. That's not to mention damage to public structures, businesses, schools, and government administration buildings.
Operations in the county pretty much stopped, with the exception of the local crop production and trying to get the crops out of the fields what they could, dealing with the flooding issues. But as far as normal businesses and things around in the county, everything pretty much stopped for 2 weeks. So any revenue that would have been provided in taxes and revenue for the local business owners and things such as that nature did completely stop for 2 weeks.
Barwick said the county qualifies for federal assistance from FEMA, but early estimates make it apparent that the cost of recovery will be steep.
As far as dollar damage assessment, I mean, we're going to be in the millions for sure.
Days were also lost to flooding. School days. Barwick said Duplin County schools were closed for 2 weeks, mainly due to road closures. Districts across the state are in limbo, and it looks like the General Assembly will, ultimately, make the final decision on school calendars.
Governor McCrory wrote in that we would, he's requesting to the government that the days be excused. I know the Duplin County schools have, since that time, they have changed a couple of days that they had listed as half days to full days to try to make up some of that time in anticipation that it wouldn't be excused. But however, if things do play out where those days are able to get excused, then I'm sure they would move toward a shortened school year, so to speak.
When facing an aftermath like the one following Hurricane Matthew, it's difficult to know where to start the recovery process. It touches most aspects of common and personal life, and creating a priority list is daunting, especially in an agrarian county like Duplin.
Growing up in a rural community, you figure out how to adapt and overcome to figure out how to make things progress, and we've had a great response from all of the employees in the county offering their assistance.
Outside civic and religious organizations have also pitched in, helping to rebuild homes and lives impacted by the second, once-in-500-year storm to occur in less than 2 decades. I'm Chris Thomas.
flooding, downed trees, and washouts were reported across eastern North Carolina during Hurricane Matthew, prompting dozens of road closures in our region. It's been nearly 3 weeks since the storm, and crews with the North Carolina Department of Transportation have been out in full force making repairs to roads and bridges. Some of the highways have reopened. Others will remain closed for some time while repairs are made. This week, I spoke with State DOT Secretary Nick Tennyson about repair efforts underway.
Right now, we've got about 350 roads across the state that are closed, which is down from about 600, and we've got people out there working right now to repair washouts that were created. Governor McCrory's been out there with our folks on a frequent basis, and I've got to tell you that does help when they look around and see that the governor's there congratulating them on their work and supporting their effort.
An official damage assessment for North Carolina isn't complete, but where would you estimate the cost of damages?
Estimated that the total recovery cost so far for the state to date would be about $17 million, with the state's share of that about $4 million. We haven't made a complete assessment on what the roads damage tab is going to be, and I wouldn't want to hazard a guess, but I can tell you that the state's fully prepared to go ahead and get those things done. County by county, we certainly are still working with crews. I think we've got about 300 people that are from Western Highway Divisions that are in the eastern part of the state helping rebuild the infrastructure that was damaged.
Have you had crews from outside of North Carolina assisting with cleanup?
There were emergency response crews that were brought in by the emergency management folks, I mean, in terms of high water rescue and some of those resources. But as to the highway portion itself, we've done that ourselves. When I say ourselves, I mean including our contractor base that we call on. That certainly came in handy down on 95 there in Lumberton. We had a contracting crew that brought in cranes and worked around the clock to make sure we could get that major highway open.
How much of a strain is this putting on your crew and resources? What kind of impact is it putting on your agency?
On the resources side, in terms of budgeting, we certainly have got this level of disaster response budgeted. So it's not creating a problem in the sense of shifting any fiscal resources from one area to another. I think really the flexibility of the contractor base is one of the other keys to this, the ability to bring people in to augment our staffing or to make sure that we shift contractors to make sure that we're able to keep delivering the projects that we've promised is one of the key elements.
Now, as NCDOT crews are repairing roads and bridges throughout eastern North Carolina, are they going to be making them stronger? So, next hurricane comes through, the infrastructure is stronger.
I think that the challenge is always to make sure we build the road to meet the need that we've set. And so it isn't really a case of rebuilding to be stronger so much as to ensure that we are building them in accordance with the specifications that we need to have, because the places where they've washed out have been places where there's been an extraordinary case, and most of the examples would be where there was overwash and we began to have erosion on the downhill side of whatever facility it was. And I don't believe that we really are ever going to be in a position where we could fully armor everything across the state. But the design characteristics that we try to put in will allow us to have a road be flooded and not have to take it out and rebuild it completely. It just needs to dry out. The drainage systems have to work, and then we'll be able to start using them again. So when you ask, are we going to rebuild them to make them withstand future storms, that there will be places where we'll have a lesson learned, where we will make sure that we've accounted for a new threat. But I would hope and I believe that we learn every day about what we need to do out here to make the road system more robust, more resilient, and try to make sure we incorporate those things as we go along.
What are some of the lessons that you learned through the process and through the recovery from Hurricane Matthew?
One of the main lessons I learned was that you can't get yourself so focused on the eye of the projected storm that you forget how far out it is that it can have an impact. The whole breadth of the storm is a threat as opposed to just looking at the eye. The other thing that I hope we've learned is that when there's a barricade on the road, you need to turn around. We had too many people who were ignoring where we had roads closed. If people won't accept a warning like that, then we have to end up going in and rescue people and sadly, outcomes that aren't that good. I think one of the other things that I found was that it was a GPS curse in a way, that people would get a detour and then they would listen to their GPS in their car and instead of following the detour. And I think we're going to need to work as closely as we can with the various providers, Google Maps and others, to make sure that we try to get detours in there that keep people going the right direction.
Well, Mr. Tennyson, I thank you so much for speaking with me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
This is Lisa Rayburn, Horticulture Agent with Onslow County Cooperative Extension, here with this week's edition of The Garden Journal. Fall is known for nights full of fright, and if you're one of those people that just loves Halloween, you might want to consider adding some spooky plants to your garden too. But don't worry, these plants won't bite, but if you incorporate some of these ghoulish plants into your landscape, they will provide frightful fun for kids of all ages. The first creepy crawly plant to consider is spider flower. With the flowing Latin name Cleome hassleriana, spider flower is a low-maintenance annual that performs best in sun to partial shade and moist soil. Its purple and white blooms are produced from summer to frost with 1-inch long petals and extended stamens that curve to give the plant its spider-like resemblance. Plants reach a height of 3 to 4 feet with a 2-foot width, making them suited for the back of the garden bed. They also make great cut flowers. This classic garden plant will often reseed, or you can easily save the seed to ensure that you have the plant year after year. Another interesting plant is eyeball plant. It is sure to be a conversation starter in the garden. The globular golden yellow flowers are centered with a red eye. When planted in full sun to light shade, these plants have a low spreading growth habit. The blooms are produced in the spring along the ends of extended stems that are surrounded by olive-colored leaves. This annual is thought to have been used in folk medicine as a toothache remedy, but it's best used today as a ground cover or in containers. Another fun consideration is ghost fern, Anthurium species variety ghost. It derives its variety name from the silvery fronds of foliage that are produced through the entire growing season. The clumping mounds of fronds will reach an average height and width of 2 to 3 feet with little maintenance and care. As a woodland plant, however, ghost fern prefers moist soil and part to full shade, where its light silver foliage will brighten even the darkest corners. If you're looking for a woody option, try blood twig dogwood. Cornus sanguinea drips with color throughout the year. Blood twig dogwood produces creamy white flowers in the spring that are followed by purple fruit and red fall foliage. The color continues through winter as stems fade from yellow to red. This plant is best suited in mass plantings for impact. A medium to large shrub, blood twig dogwood prefers sun to part shade and well-drained soil. Another exciting addition is devil's walking stick. Aurelia spinosa will provide year-round fright with its stiff, thorny branches that reach an average height of 15 to 20 feet in the landscape. This deciduous tree species will tolerate a wide range of soil conditions and sun exposure, and its leaves will produce yellow to orange-red fall color. In summer, the tree is highlighted by clustered creamy white flowers that are followed by purple to black fruits. Besides attracting onlookers, the plant also attracts bees, butterflies, and birds. And finally, don't forget to include skullcap. The stalked purple to blue blooms are produced summer to fall against small leaves covered with silvery hair. The plant will reach an average height of 2 to 4 feet. You can enjoy teasing your garden visitors with its frightful name while they enjoy its delicate blooms. So before the kids go trick-or-treating, treat yourself to a couple of new plants for the garden.
Halloween takes place Monday, though a lot of festivities are already underway. So today, we're digging up a spooky favorite from the past. Two recording sessions, about a dozen years apart, that both initially went nowhere, provided the source of material for a CD by Chapel Hill's Southern Culture on the Skids, just right for your Halloween bash. George Olson spoke with the band's members about their CD Zombified, and has this, which originally aired in October 2011.
Whenever I recommend Southern Culture on the Skids to a friend, I inevitably lead off with, how can you not like a band that has a song about banana pudding?
Banana pudding, banana pudding.
But if Southern cuisine doesn't grab your taste buds or eardrums, how about this? The Chapel Hill-based trio can seriously get ahead of a trend. Title track from their latest release, Zombified. If you're thinking, trendsetters, what about Pride and Prejudice and Zombies and AMC's The Walking Dead, Zombies Are So Last Year, dig this. Zombified was originally issued a good decade before all that. Toward the end of a brief association in the mid-1990s with Geffen Records, the band recorded the first eight tracks of the new Zombified, and there the track sat, unreleased with one exception.
I think it was a fluke that it ever got released in Australia, too.
Rick Miller, the band's guitarist and chief songwriter, following that sort of 1998 release, he says the band sold what copies it had at live shows until they ran out, meaning Zombified never enjoyed an official U.S. release until now.
Well, we had gotten a call from a producer who had done a remake of Herschel Gordon Lewis's Blood Feast called Blood Feast 2 Buffet of Blood. And he had wanted us to supply some incidental music and some soundtrack music for it. And we did, one afternoon, literally one day, I think, we came in and did a bunch of instrumental takes and sent it to him. And then we actually wrote some songs for some specific scenes, but those took a little longer. And in the meantime, he had kind of disappeared off our radar. And when we finally got back in touch with him with some of these extra songs, he said that, oh, well, the movie's already out. So we thought, well, let's just stick them on the end of Zombified and make it a real release now that we have our own record label, Kudzu Records, and just kind of treat it like it's, a new record, really.
And what was once old is now new again, though the disc is decidedly not meant to sound new. Rick describes the original eight tunes as their ode to 50s and 60s exploitation B-movies, and the music they produced for that ode was to have a decidedly time-specific feel. Bassist for Southern Culture on the Skids, Mary Huff, and drummer Dave Hartman.
Well, the whole thing sounded like it was from 1968 anyway.
You can get some of the soundtracks to a lot of those old, horror films and biker films and genre films from that era, and they all kind of have, the fuzzed out guitar and that, a lot of that kind of 60s garage kind of sound on the soundtrack, the original soundtracks.
Yeah, like the Davy Allen and the Arrows.
Davy Allen and the Arrows, Faster Pussycat, Kill Kill.
Yeah, all that stuff.
She's my witch. Likes to rock to a crazy song. Every night she's waiting on. She's a chick with a wicked twist. She's my witch.
While the new tracks were written for a film called Buffet of Blood, they're not particularly gore-filled. Again, this is a band with a song about banana pudding. The songs on Zombified are more funny than scary, with the title track less about eating brains than about work-related brain freeze. Rick Miller.
When I wrote Zombified, I was thinking more about, is my girlfriend dead or is she just overworked? You know what I mean? Because I felt pretty zombified after I get off the road, too. I think also we had been on the road a really long time before we came back and we wrote that song, and I think that probably had something to do with why I wrote it.
She answers all her questions with a yes or a no. She started wearing all them ugly brown clothes. She's too tired when we're all alone. When we're all alone. When we're all alone. When we're all alone.
Likewise, Bloodsucker is less about the life-altering effects of vampirism than it is about work issues among colleagues, and with its Caribbean lilt, it's probably the most feel-good song about the draining of bodily fluids you'll ever hear.
I started strumming it, and when I was writing the lyrics, it just seemed to like work with kind of Caribbean feel and take on it. And then I saw Interview with a Vampire, and all that stuff took place in New Orleans, and all the Creole stuff and the voodoo stuff.
I think you were drinking a 7-Up at the same time, right?
It just kind of all came together. But yeah, I think of vampires and the voodoo and a lot of that kind of swampy stuff. I mean, that's all kind of Caribbean also. Even though most people kind of do it with fuzz guitars or tremolo or things like that, I thought that's kind of creepy too.
So hey, Bloodsucker, you a real mean mother. Bloodsucker, better run for cover. Hey, Bloodsucker, I'm taking back my life.
But there is some actual horror and North Carolina lore to be found on Zombified, with a Southern culture on the skid's take on a Chatham County phenomenon, the Devil's Stomping Ground.
Supposedly walks in a circle down in Chatham County, thinking up his misdeeds, whatever, and that anything you put in that circle will be moved out of that circle the next day because he kicks it out of his way as he's walking along. That's an honest-to-goodness part of North Carolina folklore.
I tell you who's been there is Greg Bell from the Chickenwire Gang, who actually used to play keyboards in Southern Culture on the Skids, and he swears to me, as an experiment, they went there, and they all slept in sleeping bags inside the circle. And when they woke up in the morning, everybody in their sleeping bags was moved outside the circle.
So don't go hanging around when that evening sun goes down. Now don't be hanging around unless you want to go down. Be the stomping ground.
But does all the local lore and D-movie homage add up to a good listen? You betcha. I've never listened to a Southern Culture on the Skids disc and not at some point, if not several points, reached to determine the upper limits of the volume knob, always a good sign of a quality disc. And the self-deprecating humor that inevitably works its way into their original songs is hard to resist. But if my opinion isn't enough, take it straight from the head zombie's mouth.
It's timeless.
Yeah. Just like a good horror film. Honestly, I thought it all sounded quite good. We did have it remastered, and we redid the artwork. And we put it out as a vinyl LP. So we did change things a bit, you know what I mean? We upgraded the sound with remastering and got it so that those other 5 songs and the first 8 songs matched up well sonically. But hey, I love it. I love listening to it. I mean, I can't say that about all my records, but I really like listening to Zombified.
The new CD from Chapel Hill Southern Culture on the Skids is entitled Zombified and is available on the band's own Kudzu Records. I'm George Olson.
Wednesday of each month during Morning Edition for Public Radio East's newest feature, ENC Health Currents. Each month, we'll highlight the ever-changing trends in healthcare affecting Eastern North Carolina. tempered with expert opinion from local physicians and researchers. From new treatments to emerging issues, it's ENC Health Currents, sponsored by a special grant from Vidant Health. The first Wednesday morning of each month at 6:45 a.m. and 8:45 a.m. on Public Radio East.
Thanks for listening to the Downeast Journal. If you have any questions, comments, or ideas for features, drop us a line at publicradioeast.org. Have a great weekend.